This week I got thinking about one of the challenges of the Bible that people talk about, this idea that the Bible kind of has two gods, right? The God of the Old Testament, who's harsh and vindictive and filled with wrath and anger, and then the God of the New Testament, who's often portrayed as all love and forgiveness. Yahweh seems to be harsh, and Jesus is like his hippie little brother who wears tie-dye and talks about peace. Now, I don't mean to be sacrilegious. This is a real challenge, and it's discussed widely, I think, in biblical studies and even in our larger world, too. It's something that I've been thinking about for probably 30 years since I studied at Briarcrest first. Now, Andy Stanley is a well-known preacher, and he went so far as to release a book about this problem in which he kind of distances himself from the Old Testament. And we don't have time for wrestling with all the details of his argument. He does make sure beautifully that Jesus is at the center, which is awesome, right? But he also talks about unhitching from this God of the Old Testament. So what are we talking about, two different gods? You know, like, is this a real thing? I think we're aware that Paul famously said that Jesus is the image of the invisible God. And the writer of Hebrews also adds that he is the exact representation of God's being. So I think we have to look elsewhere for a solution to our challenge. And today's passage kind of has this quality to it, I think. Even though it's in the New Testament, it kind of has a sort of harshness to it. Talk of wrath for certain behaviors. So how are we going to sort this out? What I think we'll see is that Paul says, because of sexual immorality, God's wrath is poured out on the sons of disobedience. And yet the Gospels present stories of people caught in sin, even sexual sin, and Jesus says, neither do I condemn you. And again, to another sinful person, Jesus says, if you only knew the gift that God has for you. And so to these, Jesus offers something beyond wrath. Something slightly different, or maybe drastically different even. So I don't think we're talking about two different gods. So what are we talking about? Maybe another way to ask this question is to say, well, what is it that makes God angry, actually? What prompts his wrath, whether it's in the Old Testament or the New Testament? What are the things that bring about God's judgment? And I should say there's probably a few things on this list, and it actually might be a really important list for us to think about, for us to actually devote some time to think about, okay, what makes God angry? Because then we might say, yeah, I really don't want to be a part of those things that make God angry. But for today, we're just going to look at Ephesians chapter 5 for understanding in one particular area. So let's dig in to Ephesians chapter 5, and I'll start at verse 3. But sexual immorality and all impurity or covetousness must not even be named among you, as is proper among saints. Let there be no filthiness, nor foolish talk, nor crude joking, which are out of place, but instead let there be thanksgiving. For you may be sure of this, that everyone who is sexually immoral or impure, or who is covetous, that is, an idolater, has no inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God. Let no one deceive you with empty words, for because of these things, the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. So as we come to this text, we're trying to sort this issue of God's wrath and Jesus' response to people caught in sexual sin. How do we understand this tension? Well, I have a few observations for you. The first thing I would draw your attention to is this word "but" that takes place right at the beginning. It's a kind of a contrasting word. Basically, Paul is saying something that contrasts with what came before. So what did he say earlier? Well, you might recall Colin's message from last week. Ephesians 5, 1 and 2. Therefore, he says, be imitators of God as beloved children and walk in love as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us, a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. So whatever Paul's saying in verse 3, it is a contrast with the sacrificial love of God that is demonstrated to us in Jesus. And like so many areas of Ephesians, and even the whole Bible, the character and the nature of our God is our ethic. It's our morality. The way we're to behave is based in the nature of our God. And so we look to the cross, and we look to his sacrificial love. And his love does not seek its own. It's not selfish. It's not self-centered. His love is the model of care for the other. And this has to inform how we think about sexual ethics then. So when Paul says, but here, he's contrasting the behavior of our God with the thinking of our world, I think, with the issue of sexual immorality. Secondly, I think it's odd here that Paul highlights dirty joking so centrally. Like, what's the harm, right? And one of the big issues that I want us to consider this morning is this trivializing of sacred things, of things related to God's creation. Trivializing is just a simple word. It means making something less important, less significant, or less complex than it really is. And I'm suggesting that what is happening here, or what happens when we joke in these ways, when we entertain these kinds of humor, is that we trivialize what is sacred. We make it less important, less complex, and less significant than it really is. So my sense is that our world is caught in this tension. On one side, sexual experience is kind of meaningless, biological experience, sort of entertainment for adults, we might say. And this philosophy is brought to you from all kinds of directions, in music and TV and movies. You know, if you're my age, Seinfeld was a part of this, or Friends, which is now making a resurgence. And I'm fairly sure that there's a whole world of shows out there today that portray sexuality in this way as well. But even as the world takes this perspective, there is something that is still being wrestled with in popular movies and TV now. A few years back, I told Penny that we watched a movie. She doesn't remember it. Maybe we reversed roles that day and she fell asleep, not me. In any case, the movie was called Liberal Arts. It was a 2012 movie, and it's about a guy who goes back to his college 10 years later, his liberal arts college, for the retirement of a well-loved professor. And while he's there visiting for several days, a young woman propositions him. And this now 30-something young man, who had indulged significantly when he was a student, says to the student, no, I'm not going to do that. You don't know what you're messing around with. And I thought it was interesting that this movie, certainly not with no Christian background at all, had this recognition suddenly, an awareness that there's more going on to sexual experience than maybe meets the eye. And it's interesting that the perspective of the world starts to shift with this recognition. There's more to intimacy than can be defined by biology and science. And you can even hear it in music, right? Justin Bieber and Chance the Rapper have come out with a new song. I don't know how I happen upon these songs. I'm probably too old for Chance the Rapper and Justin Bieber. But anyway, they have a new song. It's called Holy. I think maybe it came out in August. And there's lots to consider in the whole song, but there seems to be this recognition of the transcendent nature of physical intimacy. Among the many lines, Bieber sings this, "The way you hold me, hold me, hold me, feels so holy, holy, holy." And he seems to acknowledge that there is a connection that is something far more than biology. There are other references in the song to baptism, to marriage, and they highlight the depth of meaning in this kind of intimacy. To sum up, I think what he's saying is that there is a divine nature to sexual intimacy, a kind of transcendence. Well, trying to steer us back on track, Paul challenges crude joking and silly talk because it trivializes this beautiful aspect of God's creation. But a third observation we can make about this passage, I don't know if you noticed this, the word coveting is in there twice. Why plug in that word in this context? Verse 3 says it this way, but sexual immorality and all impurity or covetousness must not even be named among you. And then verse 5 again, he says, for you may be sure of this, that everyone who is sexually immoral or impure or who is covetous has no inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God. And this connection between coveting and sexual sin, it actually goes all the way back to the Ten Commandments, doesn't it? You might remember, I don't know if this is your favorite commandment, the 10th one, you shall not covet your neighbor's house, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his male servant, or his female servant, or his ox, or his donkey, or anything that is your neighbor's. And it kind of reads a little awkwardly. I mean, it's only been 6,000 years, right? But it reads a little awkwardly for us. And I've often wondered, why is coveting on that top 10 list? Like, why is this one such a big deal? It's just a thought, isn't it? Just a thought that goes through your mind. You know, Cameron's got a nice truck out there, isn't it? It's just a thought if I think, oh man, I'd really like to have that truck that Cameron has. It has no impact on the world, does it? And one of the stories I always think of when I think of coveting is the story of Naboth that Colin read for us this morning. Anyway, Ahab is a king, and he sees this vineyard near his palace, and he wants it. He covets it. He desires it. So he tries to buy it, but he's denied in his desire. And as the story goes, this makes him very unhappy. He becomes discontent. Even with all that he has, he's now discontent. And Jezebel crafts this scheme to get him the vineyard, and of course, it involves harm for Naboth in order to get the thing that's desired. Naboth is killed, and Ahab gets his vineyard. And the writing of the story is actually quite deep and significant, and one day we'll spend more time there, but I'll be brief here just to say that the story warns us about the dangers of coveting, because it damages us, it damages relationships with others, and ultimately can come to significant harm. Unbridled coveting is bad for humans. We cease to enjoy what we have, and we become discontent with all things. And at times, it harms relationships and the people involved. So Paul highlights coveting. And I think at this point, we have one of those clashes between the philosophy of our world and the thoughts of the Creator. The world says desire of all kinds is good. Take what you want. Fulfill yourself. And God says that the path of unbridled desire is actually harmful for us and for those around us. And we need only look so far as the massive pornography industry that has built empires out of helping people to covet. And it's often portrayed as harmless, even the source of a joke. We treat it lightly. And I think in the past I've mentioned this website called Fight the New Drug. It's a helpful site for people struggling with addiction, but it speaks plainly about the negative impact on humans. Here's a quote from the website. After being exposed to pornography, men reported being less satisfied with their partner's physical appearance, sexual performance, and level of affection, and expressed greater desire for sex without emotional involvement. Friends, this is not rocket science what we're talking about here. Coveting in the form of pornography has so many negative effects on users, on their spouses, on society in general, and even, we don't often think of this, but on the people who work to produce these things, too. It's Naboth's vineyard in so many ways. People are being harmed. And the problem is that there is this transcendent thing. You see, the society tells us, let desire run, because it's just biology after all. But the problem is that there is this transcendent quality to intimacy that happens between humans. And it has to be recognized. We have to acknowledge it. And in any relationship of high human intimacy, there exists the possibility for high human good or high human harm. Right? Any situation of high human intimacy presents the opportunity for high human good or high human harm. stepping out of the world of romance and sexuality, a parent has the ability to do great good for a child or great harm. Far more than a casual acquaintance, far more than someone who says a word just in passing, a parent has a closer relationship, and this means they can have greater impact. High human intimacy equals an opportunity for high human good or high human harm. Well, last week I became aware of a song that has sort of exploded on the world of Spotify. It was written by a woman, a young woman named Olivia Rodrigo. And a couple of weeks ago, it set a record on Spotify for the highest number of streams in a day for a non-holiday song. So non-holiday song means that Kenny G's Christmas album is still at the top or something. I'm sure that's what it is. Anyway, she set a record for the highest number of streams in a day with 15 million, and 3 days later broke it again at 17 million. So I thought, well, I should probably take that song for a spin. Now, before you race out there to listen to it, there is a little bit of salty language in there, so be careful. Anyway, I wonder what makes the song so powerful. And there's probably lots of things. I mean, there's this like incredible angsty style to it. I don't know if Billie Eilish means anything to you, but it has that sort of like angsty quality to it. She has a terrific voice, so like there's reason why people might be listening to it. But behind the song, there appears to be a true story, and the story has leaked out. Story of a young woman who was looking forward to getting her driver's license because she and her boyfriend were planning that she would come and pick him up, and they'd go for a drive together when she got her license. Well, you might guess that the relationship dissolved before this could take place. And throughout the song, she wrestles with all the feelings of hurt that she's experiencing around this song. Have you guys heard this song? Do you know? No. You should maybe look it up, but maybe don't look it up too. I don't know. Anyway, so she's wrestling with the hurt, and the song really crescendos, and it gets loud and exaggerated, but then suddenly she quiets at this key moment, and she sings, "You said forever, now I drive alone past your street." Yeah? That's what she says. And it's pretty potent, especially with the crescendo of the music, and then it just it decrescendos, yeah? It stops crescendoing, and then she says this great line, "You said forever, now I drive alone past your street." It's powerful. It's really powerful. Anyway, obviously, I have no sense of the level of intimacy in their relationship. I have no idea about that. But what is clear is that whatever level of intimacy they had together, there's a kind of ripping that takes place. Because sexual intimacy or intimacy of any kind bonds people together. Our souls become tied. And it's painful when this intimacy is torn away. We don't so easily move on. And on some level, Rodrigo's pain is resonating with a very large group of people. Now, Rodrigo's song prompts this question. How can you know when the words of commitment are real? How do you know when someone is truly unselfish? And who can you really trust? Well, if only there was some way of really knowing. If only there was some way of knowing who's going to be unselfish about their love. If only there was some way of knowing who is going to be truly committed for their whole life. If only we had some method of, say, formalizing that promise, "I'm going to be with you forever." Then a person could, if you can imagine this, they could give themselves without reservation. And it would be beautiful, wouldn't it? To give yourself freely and without reservation. If only there was a way that vows could be stated, say, before God and witnesses, family and friends. If only there was a way, wouldn't that be a cause for celebration? Wouldn't that be a time to gather families together, to sing and to dance and to feast and to celebrate? Wouldn't that be a beautiful thing? If only there was a way. Someone should really invent something like that. It would be a good idea, I think. Friends, this is God's design. Man and woman in committed love. And this is the source of bringing new life into our world. This is what God has designed for us. Friends, I encourage you, when it's time to have that talk with your kids, maybe just ask this question. What does a baby need? What does a baby need? Well, a baby needs commitment, stability, sacrificial love, like a stable home environment. A baby needs all these things. Now, isn't that the place? Isn't that the place where we want children to enter the scene, right? And so God has created this. This is the place, the appropriate place for sexual love. And what we're talking about ultimately is this clash of philosophies. Society says sex and intimacy is just biology or entertainment even. But our experience of life tells us there's something much more going on here. Intimacy, commitment, and connection without fear. Now, I don't want to pretend that marriage is just easy, right? That you just get married and all your problems go away. A spouse that I know very well says it magnifies your problems. I'm not sure what she's saying exactly. But most often, it introduces you to new problems, doesn't it? Marriage does. So it doesn't make all your problems go away, but the commitment of marriage actually helps you to work through your problems, to resolve differences. Well, let's recap for a few minutes here. So we started by asking this question, is there two gods, an Old Testament God and a New Testament God? The Bible says no. Then we ask, what is it that makes God angry in the Old Testament and the New Testament? And we talked about this contrast between God's sacrificial love and our world's view of sexual ethics, which is basically take what you can. And we talked about the trivializing of the sacred, ways in which people can treat sexuality as less important, less significant, and less complex than it actually is. Then we added this piece about coveting, didn't we? Ways in which harm is done when desire goes unbridled. Harm to self, harm to partners, and harm even to society. Well, finally, we tapped into this notion that actually, in the place of high human intimacy, exists the possibility for high human good or high human harm. So friends, what is it that makes God angry? Old Testament, New Testament, Jesus, Yahweh, what is it that makes God angry? Friends, when we take this sacredness of human intimacy, unselfish, committed love, and when we spin lies about that, that it's meaningless or trivial or mere recreation, and those lies harm people deeply to the point that they struggle to find life anymore. Friends, there's no soft way to say this. God rages at this. It makes him very, very angry. His wrath is kindled against this. And this thing that's meant for high human good, for fulfillment and the creation of life itself, suddenly becomes a tool of despair and brokenness for so many people. It angers him. It angers him. It rightly angers him. Well, let's pick up in verse 7 with Paul again here. Therefore, do not become partners with them. That seems like an understatement, doesn't it? Do not become partners with them. For at one time you were darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of light, for the fruit of light is found in all that is good and right and true. And try to discern what is pleasing to the Lord. Take no part in the unfruitful works of darkness, but instead expose them. For it's shameful even to speak of the things that they do in secret. But when anything is exposed by the light, it becomes visible. For anything that becomes visible is light. Therefore, it says, awake, O sleeper, and arise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you. Well, I think we have two pictures here at work. And Paul kind of mixes his metaphors, too. There's fruit and light. And at one point, he talks about the fruit of light, which is the beautiful mixed metaphor, which I love. But light here speaks to, I think, the lostness of people who are living under a misguided philosophy. that is so widely held and believed and portrayed and taught, and people are living under these ideas and then wondering why they're not finding life. They're finding darkness. Secondly, fruit. The worldview of our society does not produce fruit. It produces thistles and thorns. It's a life that doesn't produce the things that humans hope for, like intimacy and love and care and connection. It doesn't produce these things. Well, in the past, I've talked to you about this book. It's called Sex and the Soul by Donna Freitas. She used to be a Boston University professor, and she was teaching a class on human sexuality. And what she was hearing consistently was students opening up about their dissatisfaction with hookup culture. And in these stories, both men and women, there was this recurring theme of people looking for real intimacy and getting much less than they hoped for, leaving them really quite broken and unsatisfied. And as you read the stories, it's pretty dark, actually, and a little bit depressing. There's a disturbing quality to them, in which heartbreaking story after heartbreaking story, it just leaves you feeling pretty blue. But there was one story that I'd like to read to you. It's a story of a student named Emily Holland. It starts off with a quote from Emily here. She says, "Oh, sex is wonderful," gushes Emily Holland, an unusual confession for someone at an evangelical college. Emily wears a smart pale green suit, dressed as if her meeting today is really a job interview. Her cheeks turn pink, her long eyelashes flutter, and her blue eyes dance as she draws out each syllable. My eyes open wide as I try to hide my surprise. It's not that I haven't met other evangelical students who have had sex, but they are typically regretful, mortified, angry, or fearful. Emily is decidedly different. Like most of her peers, Emily grew up in a very religious household, went to church every Sunday, sometimes more than once, prayed and studied the Bible at home with her family, and was part of a youth group. She describes herself as very involved and very religious and very spiritual. In her journal, she writes that she has religious experiences all the time because she walks every day with God. Emily decided to attend an evangelical college because she wanted to surround herself with fellow students and faculty who would hold her accountable in her faith. Nonetheless, Emily is effusive about sex. "I have a very healthy sex life," she continues happily. She then does something that makes me understand why she's not conflicted about sex. She takes her left hand from her lap and displays it on the table between us, revealing a big diamond ring. At 21, Emily is already married. And that story, friends, that story in that book stands out like you cannot imagine. When all the world is filled with angst or guilt or even a nasty kind of anger around sexuality, that story represents the one person who appears to be truly free. And it's beautiful. Well, we've been at this a long time, a long conversation about a heavy topic. Let's ground some of these ideas for a moment here. First of all, the self-sacrificing love of God is at the center. And when we think about sexuality, this is the primary teaching of the Bible. So today, married or single, old or young, male or female, the call of Jesus is the call to an unselfish life. Is there an area of your life where you're holding on to selfishness? If you're like me, it's probably have lots of choices, actually. Let go of it. Paul would say to us, "Take no part in the unfruitful works of darkness. There is a better life to be had, a fruitful life." Secondly, Paul says to expose the unfruitful works of darkness. We're all in different life situations, and we all have different kinds of connections in our life, different contacts with different people. And some of us, when we engage with people, we find their lives have been harmed by the teaching of our world in the area of sexuality. exposing the error here does not have to be harsh. It can be as simple as listening carefully to a story and then gently saying, you know, there might be a better way. Years ago, I think our society had a pretty clear concept of what morality looked like in this area, but this is not true anymore. And so when we engage these conversations, we need to speak the truth in gentleness and love, and to be exactly what our friend needs to hear. There might be a better way. Third, I want to just spend a brief moment here talking about homosexuality. I had given a talk like this to a group of students about 10 years ago, and at the end of the talk, a young man approached me, and he says, okay, that's all well and good, but I'm same-sex attracted. How does this apply to me? And to be clear here, this church holds the church's historic position on homosexuality, but we want to do so in a way that acknowledges God's love and grace for all people of all kinds. And so if this is your situation, I hope you wouldn't feel like you have to struggle alone. I would invite you to an ongoing conversation in the same way that I had a beautiful friendship with that young man 10 years ago. Don't struggle alone. Don't feel like you have to be isolated. Let's talk about these things. And finally, this piece. No doubt there are people here who have been caught up in the world's point of view on sexuality. And one of the central points of the Christian faith is that our God is a God who forgives sin and heals shame. And he's able to meet you where you are at and to set you on the path of restoration. Friends, the whole series of on Ephesians has been centered on this uniting all things in Christ, bringing healing to our fractured world. And the area of human sexuality in Canada is an area that needs tremendous healing. There are fractures occurring daily because in the place of high human intimacy, there exists the possibility for high human good or high human harm. And we have this opportunity to be a source of healing in our world and to bring all these things under the lordship of Christ. Well, let's pray together. Father, in all these things, we surrender ourselves to you. In our weaknesses and in our failures, you've met us and you've offered us forgiveness and hope and healing. Beautifully, there are no second-class citizens in the kingdom because your forgiveness is full and free. So, Lord, in this area of our personal lives, but also in our city, we pray that your healing would come to us and that we would be also that source of healing for our world. And so more than we can ask or imagine, prepare us for these things. Give us these gifts that we would represent your true nature in the world. In Jesus' name I pray.